was an ocean of tall rustling prairie grass, shining and rippling like waves on the sea. We built steam engines to sail that wide prairie and charted our course with a lifeline of steel.
Lisa Johnson has a wonderful voice, doesn't she? She has a CD out. It's called The Season, distributed, by the way, or you can download it from CD Baby. And it's a perfect song for today's program because we're going to be talking about prairies. And if you want those beautiful prairies, maybe just in your lawn area or in a small area, or maybe you got a large area, this is the program for you because Neil DeBall is here. He is president of Prairie Nursery, recognized internationally for his work and expertise in native plant community ecology. It's always fun to have Neil come by. Certainly, if you have questions as we move along, maybe it's about seeding, maybe it's about burning, maybe it's about site preparation, maybe it's about controlling the weeds that you've got. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Neil DeBall, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be here on Garden Talk with you.
Well, it's always great to have you here. How's business, by the way? Pretty good?
Business is good. I think, you know, we're seeing this really gradual but sustainable trend towards sustainable gardening with native plants. And when I went into this 37 years ago, you know, it was just kind of getting going. People said, oh, it's just a fad. Well, it was a fad among a very few people, let me tell you, because business was not good 37 years ago when you're trying to sell what were considered weeds. But now people understand the importance of native plants, especially within the larger scope of the ecosystem, and how pollinators are such an important part of not only just the general planet's health, but also food production and interconnectedness between our landscapes and our environmental health is really becoming clearer and clearer, and native plants are such an important part of that. And people are really starting to really do it. They're really starting to convert their landscapes. Yeah, and it's for a good reason, and it really works.
Well, I tell you, one of the things that has struck me when you and I have talked, site preparation comes up as a conversation. I think we even ought to lead with that today because if you want to be disappointed, you can do a poor job of site preparation, and then you're not going to be happy probably.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Larry. And this type of landscaping with native plants where you're not just putting in a garden, in many cases you are creating a plant community. Now, we do have – a lot of people do use our transplants to create a garden on a smaller scale.
Sure.
And you can make beautiful perennial gardens using all native prairie plants that rival any English garden. And you can also do larger landscapes using seeds of 1,000 square feet or multiple acres, anywhere in between, and have wonderful results. But the site preparation is critical. And this is a deferred gratification program. So, you know, a lot of Americans don't understand deferred gratification and they're not willing to wait. And if you're not willing to wait, then don't do it. This is not for you. But for people who are willing to take the time to do it right, you get your site prepared properly, then you are on the road to success.
And how hard is that?
Well, it depends on what you're up against. The first thing you do whenever you're evaluating a landscape conversion project where you have, say, it's a lawn. Really simple. Lawns are easy to kill. You can smother them. Just cover them with carpets or black plastic or cardboard for a full growing season from April through October, and that should kill everything unless you have some problem weeds in there. But most weeds will also be killed with one growing season of smothering. Exceptions include things like Canada thistle, field bindweed. These can survive a year of covering and smothering. But that's an organic method. Don't have to use any chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
It takes 1 year, and your lawn is ready to go. If you are ambitious, you can till up your lawn, but boy, that's a lot of work because it's hard to till up sod, and you would have to do it repeatedly in order to kill all the sod. I have done it. I don't do it anymore, and there's a good reason why I don't do that anymore. Okay? And of course, then if you're, it's okay with you personally, then you can use herbicides like glyphosate, i.e. Roundup, to kill off the lawn or whatever else you're up against. But when you have an old abandoned field where it's grown up to weeds and aggressive grasses and maybe some young trees and shrubs, now you've got a whole different story where you're going to probably have to spend 2 years just killing everything off, whether that is cutting everything down and tilling it every 3 to 4 weeks for 2 years. Oh, you want to do that? I've done that. That's the organic method. You would only do that on a level area, not on a sloping area where you could create erosion. You can smother it for 2 years. That's perfectly reasonable. On larger acres, you can use smother crops where you use a combination of buckwheat in the summer and then winter wheat that you would plant in September. You grow the buckwheat from June to August, cut it down, till it in, and then plant your winter wheat in September, and then do that 2 years in a row. But it's going to take 2 years no matter what methods you use. And, of course, you could go in there and spray it with herbicides such as glyphosate, and that is also a two-year process where you would spray it 2 to 3 times a year, every 2 months, usually 3 times a year, and that will usually kill everything. The benefit of using the herbicide method is that you're not tilling. And every time you till, you bring up more weed seeds. So if you're using an agricultural method like smother crops with the buckwheat, winter wheat rotation, or if you're using a tillage, just repeated tillage method, you're bringing up new weed seeds every time. Whereas if you're smothering or if you're spraying with an herbicide, you're not bringing up the new weed seeds. And then you would do a no-till seeding where you never till the soil when you put your seeds in the ground, which would almost always be in fall, because if you're doing a no-till seeding, you want the seed to work its way down into the soil with the frost heaving over the winter.
So almost right about now, if you were seeding for fall.
If you were seeding for fall, a lot of people start in late August.
Oh, they do.
Yeah. And it used to be, well, the seeds will germinate in September and they'll die over the winter. But, you know, I've been doing this 40 years and I've never seen the seeds do that. So, you know, we anthropomorphize and think that we know better than the seeds. I mean, I planted prairies in the middle of August, which we don't recommend. But the construction site was ready and it had to be vegetated. That was the law. We did it. And I thought, I don't think this is going to work. This is 30-something years ago. It turned out beautifully. So, you know, the time of seeding is less and less important if you've done the site preparation. If you do not do the site preparation, you are probably doomed.
Yeah.
And I tell people, site preparation for any planting, whether it's a lawn, a native planting, it's like the foundation of a house. You could build a $10 million house on a lousy foundation and the whole thing is going to fall down. Same thing here. You could put in thousands of dollars of wonderful first-class prairie seed, but if you didn't do your site preparation, it's probably going to fail. So you've got to take your time.
Well, let's take some calls, find out what's on everybody's mind here. By the way, there's an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Scott in Washburn will give you a chance. Scott, thank you. Oh, we lost Scott. Okay, let's go to Tom in Brilliant. Tom, hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, I've got a question. We put in the CRP pollinator habitat last year, so this is the second year of growth. And it's turning out pretty good, but the question is now, should I mow it at this time of year or just leave it,
okay,
it at this point?
This is the second year, you said, Tom?
Yes.
Okay. How tall are the plants, the general height of what's growing there? Probably, what, 5 feet high?
Yeah, there's some that go that high. A lot of black-eyed Susan.
Okay.
It turned out pretty thick, but there's a lot of everything in it, including stuff we didn't plant.
Of course, of course. And the black-eyed Susans are probably averaging 2 feet, 2.5 feet tall. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Okay. At least that.
At least that. Okay, you have a bit of a conundrum here. Okay, you've got your beautiful black-eyed Susans, which are biennial. Therefore, they are blooming in the second year, so that's a good sign. That's kind of your canary in a coal mine. If you don't have black-eyed Susans in the second year of a seeding that contained black-eyed Susans in the mix, if they're not there, you probably have larger problems. But if you see them, that probably means the other longer-lived perennial species are also probably present. So at this point, you're almost towards the end of the season. So the advantage of mowing is to knock down the weeds that are obscuring sunlight to the ground for the slower growing perennial prairie plants. Well, in May, June, July, August, and into September, that's really the prime growing season. So you only have about another month of prime growing season. So the advantage of mowing at this point is greatly reduced compared to earlier in the season. Now, one of the advantages of mowing now, depending on the species, is you can prevent seed formation of some problematic weeds if they are forming seeds. Some may have already formed seeds and it's too late, but some may not have. So there would be an advantage to mowing now in weed control if you have perennial weeds. Annual weeds like foxtail and pigweed and lamb's quarters, that doesn't matter because those are not going to be a long-term problem. But if you have any biennial or perennial weeds, especially biennial weeds like sweet clover, Queen Anne's lace, wild parsnip, these are plants, biennials, that are really problematic, and we keep them mowed. However, late August is too late for most of these because they've already made their seeds. So we would normally mow them in late June, maybe early July. So your window of opportunity for mowing a second-year prairie is well past what would be optimal. So you wouldn't get much control of seed production because it's already occurred. So at this point, you may, if the weeds are not too dense, just enjoy your black-eyed Susans and don't worry about it. If the weeds are really dense and they are causing a lot of shade at the bottom of the, at the ground level where your slower-growing, smaller perennial prairie plants are, then it might be beneficial to mow and get another month of growth out of those.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Judy in Bayfield next. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, Roundup is really on the no-purchase list for most of us, and I wondered, Neil, if you have an alternative herbicide, because we're looking at Parkinson's and lymphoma and all sorts of things from Roundup.
Yeah.
There's a lot of controversy about glyphosate. That's why we tell people you have lots of different ways that you can prepare your site, organically or non-organically. A lot of different research on it. I'm not an expert at this, so I'm not going to claim to be that. The European Union has come out pretty strongly against glyphosate. Interestingly, Health Canada just reissued a second opinion on glyphosate earlier this year. They did a study in 2017 of all the literature, and they came out and said there was no correlation between at least cancers and glyphosate. And they redid that study with a whole new panel, all new people, in 2019, and said that they came to the same conclusion, that there was no statistical correlation. That was Health Canada's result.
That's what they did.
Right. But there, I mean, you got all kinds of competing studies here. So, you know, if you want to be safe, don't use it. That's really simple. Okay. And there's a lot of things people said years ago, oh, it's safe. DDT is perfectly safe. Okay. What became of that? So a skeptical approach is really important. So what do you do instead? There are some acetic acid and organic acid herbicides out there that are fairly effective, but they're really good on annuals, but they're not particularly good on perennials, especially rhizomatous perennials like quackgrass, smooth bromegrass, Canada goldenrod, some of these really hard-to-kill plants because they really pretty much only kill the leaves. They don't translocate as well down into the roots as some of your more systemic chemical herbicides. So repeated applications of these organic acid herbicides.
What would be an example of one?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of different trade names out there. Yeah. Most of them have strong acetic acid.
They'll say on the label.
Yeah.
15%.
Something like that. Yeah.
Acetic acid or whatever.
Exactly. Some have more than 15%. So there are a number of these products out there. And I mean, you want to be careful with them too. I mean, they actually are more toxic than, you know, innately toxic than glyphosate. The LD50 for glyphosate, which is what would take the dose it would take to kill half of a treated population, is twice that of salt, of table salt. Now, who's going to ingest that much of salt or glyphosate? But it just tells you the acute toxicity. But that does not cover the long-term effects that could lead to cancers and other diseases.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of controversy. If you're concerned, I would play it safe and just avoid it. But it's unfortunately, there's no real as effective systemic herbicide that's on the market at this time, although there's some fairly good alternatives, but you'll have to repeatedly apply them.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at prairies today and prairie gardens with our guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk. If you have a question or a comment, maybe you want to know how to get a prairie going in your lawn or in your area, maybe you have questions about what you already have in there that are possibly creating problems, or maybe just a general question. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ron in Norwalk has something for you. Neil, let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Neil. I just want to make a quick comment, and then I do have a question. But my comment is I wanted to thank Neil for what he's doing for our landscape. I've got three areas now that I planted down to seed, and I started about 5 years ago. And what it really helped was all the information that you have on your website. You're not afraid to share your knowledge, and I think that really helps because it made mine successful, and I'm sure it's for others. So thank you for sharing your knowledge and sharing it openly, because I think it really helped a lot of people.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate that. That's great.
You bet. My question is, it was kind of initial to be talking about site preparation. I do have three areas. Two of them are very successful, and the last one isn't as much so, and it's because of my poor site preparation. But I have an area. I planted it to kind of your clay mixture.
Yeah, clay busters.
And yes, and it's got a lot of Queen Anne's lace in it. And unfortunately, last spring, I wasn't able to burn it. It's going on its third year now, but I did clip it. But what's from moving forward now, of course, it's went to seed and whatnot. So I guess moving forward on this small patch here, what can I do to are the prairie plants still going to be there, or has the Queen Anne's lace kind of overtaken? I mean, there seems to be a lot of it.
What's the
how I can kind of work on it now?
Yeah, you said a small patch. What's your definition of small, Ron?
It's about, I would say, about 100 feet long by about 10 feet wide.
Okay.
Well, Queen Anne's lace is a non-native biennial. It's also known as wild carrot, from which our commercial carrots that we eat are derived, Daucus carota. And it can be a pretty aggressive weed. Now, it is a biennial. And it's one of the few biennials that can maintain itself in a grassland system. Another biennial, two biennials that are similar to that, are the sweet clovers, white and yellow sweet clover, genus Melilotus. These can be really horrific problems in prairies. Now that your Queen Anne's lace has gone to seed, Ron, you're pretty much doomed. Or you're going to have wonderful, beautiful Queen Anne's lace for years to come. Because the seeds of the Queen Anne's lace, as well as the sweet clover, can remain viable and dormant in the soil for decades. And I will tell you a story. This is how stupid I am. I had one Queen Anne's lace that showed up in my beautiful prairie many years ago. This is like 15, 20 years ago. I said, oh, isn't that beautiful? I'll just enjoy this Queen Anne's lace because it is a pretty flower. Well, I failed to go out and clip the seed heads off before they dropped. It is now 20 years, and I am still pulling Queen Anne's lace out of that prairie. And I have a zero-tolerance program. I pull every single one. So those seeds are coming up from that 1 year that I let them go.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's really bad news plant. So what do you do? Well, because it's a biennial and it's a cool season plant, it comes up fairly early in spring. You can get some level of control with a mid-spring burn, like around May, early May, and that will oftentimes kill the two-year plants as they come up. Not reliably, but oftentimes you get good control. But you'll still have more seedlings that come up, so it becomes a long-term struggle. The problem with burning later in the spring is that if you do it repeatedly, you will tend to push the equilibrium of your prairie more towards the warm season prairie grasses and away from many of the flowers. So the floriferousness of your prairie will suffer if you use this method. And we use this method for controlling cool season weeds like quackgrass and smooth broom grass and bluegrass and clovers and Queen Anne's lace and other horrible plants that can be a problem. So you have to be really careful with this management technique. So the best answer here is prevention. And so if you have Queen Anne's lace that show up in your prairie, in the first year, go out. If it's a small prairie, clip those seed heads off and do not leave a one behind. If it's a large area, you have to go out there and mow them off before they mature. And the problem with Queen Anne's lace is it's an indeterminate bloomer and ripener. So that means that it will continue to bloom. You can mow it and then it'll rebloom. And then if you mow it, it'll rebloom. So it's a real booger. Sweet clover is a determinate bloomer, so you can hit it just right after it blooms and cut it down at 12 inches, usually in early to mid-July, and be done with it. So but Queen Anne's lace does not give you that option. It's a much more difficult to control weed. So the other choice is it's a beautiful flower and enjoy it. It won't it will not kill your prairie, but it will be a very significant part of the plant community if left alone.
So
Tough one.
How many years have you been pulling it out of yours?
Oh, like 20 years. Yeah.
20 years.
Yeah, but my prairie is 30 years old, this particular planting. And I put it, and I just had one plant, one single plant. Oh. And I was, oh, it's pretty, you know, knowing full well what it could do. And I'll clip the seeds off. Well, you know, I got busy with 13 other projects, and the seeds fell in the ground, and it is still coming up.
On that happy note, let's turn to Nancy in La Crosse. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I sure enjoy your show, and having the speaker today is like a godsend.
Oh, wonderful.
I have a prairie that's about 7 years old, and it's a medium size and on a steep bank or steep hill. And my problem is some of the plants that seem to like the environment are just way too tall, like 6 feet tall. And so they smother out all my other plants, like coneflowers and monarda, that I would prefer to show. And I talked to Neil earlier about the goldenrod, and I proceeded to pull out hundreds of goldenrod because it was like 6 feet tall. So my question is, I have a variety of sunflowers, false sunflowers. They're all blooming now yellow, but they too are tall. And I like them. I don't want them to leave, but I was wondering if it would work to manage them by every spring, like when they get perhaps 4 feet tall, cut them back to two or so. And would I hurt the plant but still get everything but in a shorter version?
Okay, when you say false sunflower, are we talking about Heliopsis helianthoides? Do you know the Latin name, Nancy?
No, I don't.
Those are mostly
they're really tall yellow now. They have a yellow center, kind of a thin stem on it.
Okay.
Very slight. Their stem isn't very strong.
Yeah.
That sounds like a true sunflower because the early sunflower or oxeye sunflower bloom in July and they're pretty much done. They also have more of a yellow center, but they're pretty much done. So the true sunflowers are big bloomers in August and September. And it's how tall? 6 feet? 8 feet?
Probably six, at least.
Okay.
Six, seven.
Okay. It could be showy sunflower.
Okay. Initially, when I first planted all this, there's many varieties that I've never seen. So I'm not sure really all what I have after this length of time. But
sure.
This is what's blooming now. But the problem is my bank is so steep.
Mm-hmm.
That they bend over, like, and then they don't maintain their beauty, and
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
well, you could, if you just wanted to reduce the vigor of the sunflowers, you could just before they bloom, or before they get taller than you want them, is to just cut them down at the ground level. Now that would almost certainly prevent them from blooming in that year that you cut them. But that would prevent them from seeding and potentially spreading by seed, and it would get them out of the way of your other plants. It's not a long-term solution, but it is a temporary solution for that given year. I don't know if that's an acceptable strategy for you.
Early summer,
well,
and have them bloom yet, but be shorter, like 4 feet?
If you cut them in early summer, then they would resprout and bloom later and probably shorter, although that's... Depends on the time of the cutting.
Yeah.
So here's what I would do. Do an experiment. Cut some in June, cut some in July, cut some in August, and see what you get.
Oh.
And see what the response is. And then you'll know for future years what each of those treatments did. And then you can do accordingly in the following year. So you'll see what the results are on your site with the species that you've got. And the Canada goldenrod, and you said goldenrod. I want to make it very clear. As I recall, Nancy, you have Canada goldenrod. It forms those big clones, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, as opposed to the prairie goldenrods, like stiff goldenrod, showy goldenrod, which generally are better behaved, although stiff goldenrod sometimes can be fairly aggressive by seed. But the Canada goldenrod is a native plant, but it's nothing that we ever put in our mixers because it's a highly aggressive, clonal, rhizomatous species that likes to take over. And prairie plants will survive underneath it, but you won't hardly see them. They're just hanging on. And so Canada goldenrod is one of our absolute worst weeds, and it's a native plant.
Yeah.
Just because a plant is native doesn't mean it's good. Just because a plant's non-native doesn't mean it's bad. So here's a real thug. And another reason why you want to make sure, as part of that site preparation process, you don't have any roots of Canada goldenrod left in your area. And also make sure that you don't have areas of Canada goldenrod growing nearby, adjacent to where you want to put in a prairie, because the seeds can blow in and colonize in there too. So you want to really be cognizant of that plant.
And Nancy, don't do like I do. instead of thinking, well, I'm going to remember which sunflowers I cut in June and which ones I cut in July and which ones I cut in August, and then never remember.
Make a map.
Make a map.
Make a map. Yep.
Make a map.
Absolutely, make a map.
That's my advice to you based on my own experiences with other plants, with sunflowers.
Isn't it funny when you do it? I'll remember this.
Yeah.
And then 2 months later, what did I do?
Yeah.
Where was I? What did I cut?
It's amazing. Oh, boy. Good luck, Nancy. Thank you very much for calling. Carrie in Cudahy, it's your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I have a question on viburnums, and I have a Chicago Luster, Arrowwood viburnum, and a Korean spice. And I was wondering how the beetles, the viburnum beetles, are affecting our native viburnums and how to treat that.
Well, that's a good question. I am not an entomologist, so this is really out of my area of expertise, but we have seen problems with some of the native viburnums and a certain beetle, and I apologize, I cannot remember the exact name of that beetle, but it can really decimate plants. And we did see some problems with a viburnum beetle this year on the native nannyberry.
You might check in with the insect diagnostic lab at the UW-Madison. I'd say send a note. Just go to UW Insect Diagnostic Lab online, and you can, if you've got a photo of the insect, but PJ Leash might even know without, but probably if you had a photo, it would be a whole lot better. And he might well have some advice for you. And he's pretty good about, that's what he does for a living. He's pretty good about answering questions pretty quickly.
He'll do a lot better job than I will.
Okay, there you go, Carrie. Thanks a lot for calling. Ben in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Very useful right now. So my question or my challenge right now is that I have a lot of nettles in my yard in Madison. So I'm in town. I've had the house, the yard for this is, I guess, my fourth summer. And two summers ago, I tried to just mow it all down and cover it and smother it. Well, this is the end of the second summer of that all being covered with kind of a ground tarp, and the nettles are growing through. Whether my dog kind of runs around and little holes in the fabric, and normally I would just kind of leave the nettles, but I've got two young kids and I just don't want to have nettles growing in my yard.
Okay, so this is just a wild area in the back of your yard. You didn't plant anything there. It's just what's there. Is that correct, Ben?
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, nettles are another rhizomatous, fairly aggressive plant. They like to grow in rich, damp soils usually, moist soils, not damp, but moist, rich soils. So if you have good ground, which you probably do, they love it and they get 6 feet tall and your kids run into them and they come screaming into the house, right?
Yeah.
So, and it likes disturbed ground. So if you had an area that was disturbed, that's where nettles will usually become established, but they can retain their control over that area for many years. So it sounds like you want to get rid of them. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do. It's more in the back of the yard, kind of underneath a couple fairly mature maples.
Okay.
So they kind of get some sunlight, and I would love to replace it with, I mean, really anything. But just as long as some like lilies are back there mixed in, so I'm sure the previous owners decades ago had good intentions, but just the nettles have totally overgrown.
Yeah. And so you tried to smother them.
Yeah.
And you smothered them for 2 years and that didn't kill them?
No, they are right now. If you look back there, it would look like they're smaller versions of what they were 2 years ago.
So you took?
I took a garden fabric, rated for the thickest that I thought, and I used little garden stakes, and I covered. I mean, this is about, I don't know, maybe like a 2,000 square foot area. And just over the course of 2 years, the disturbance and little holes in the fabric would happen with
right.
my,
yeah.
And then they come
know.
Through.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to have a non-permeable material that they can't come up through. And another problem when people use black plastic, if it's not even a heavy duty, thick plastic,
yeah.
If you have deer, the deer will walk on it and punch holes with their hooves, and then the weeds come up through the holes. So, yeah, you got to pick a fabric that's really going to. So that's why a lot of people go to like appliance stores and get the cardboard they throw out, big giant pieces of cardboard, and put three layers of that down, and make sure you overlap them so there's no seams where the plants can come through, and leave that down for. And a lot of people put wood chips over that, so you got three layers of cardboard. And then at least 3 hours of cardboard, and then wood chips over that. And that's usually a pretty impervious environment. As the wood chips begin to break down after a couple of years, then you plant into that. Most people put transplants through that, and the cardboard has rotted, and you can plant your garden plants in. If you leave it there for years, then the wood chips rot, and then in move the weeds. Okay. So once the wood chips rot and form soil, then it becomes a nice place for weeds to grow. Canada thistle seems to love wood chips. It just is able to grow prolifically in that. So I think your smothering methodology is the problem here. You need to have something that's impervious that those nettles cannot come up through. But they're a tough customer. They really are.
But I like the cardboard idea.
Cardboard, a lot of people use that very successfully, cardboard with 2-3 inches of fresh wood chips over that. There's little or no soil available,
right.
And then you have the high carbon to nitrogen ratio of the wood chips, so very few plants can grow in that environment because there's not enough nitrogen. So it really pretty much excludes weeds and grasses for a couple of years, and then you can put your plants in through that, and the cardboard's rotted. Just pull away the wood chips, dig a hole through the cardboard into the soil, and boom, put in your plants.
There you go, Ben. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill in Madison emailed that in 2017 they lost 150 large white pines and oaks in a tornado on their lake property in Washera County. They now have a large empty swath of land that's surrounded by the remaining oak and pines. The swath is 300 by 200 feet. They're trying to figure out what to do with the empty spot and wondering if a prairie would work there.
A prairie is a very good idea, especially in Washington County, where I'm guessing that they probably have sandy soil.
Yeah.
And prairies are great for sandy soils because by selecting the right plants, many, many of your prairie plants are very drought tolerant. And another thing about dry sandy soils is that it tends to exclude many of the weeds that bedevil us on richer soils. That's not to say that there are not some problem weeds that occur on sandy soils. You still get quackgrass. You have spotted knapweed, which is a big problem on dry sandy soils, and others. But generally speaking, you have lower weed pressure, and it's easier to establish a prairie on a dry sandy soil than it is on a richer loamy soil or clay soil. So you could go in there in the fall and scatter seed. I don't know if there's tree debris, you want to get all the debris out of there. There may still be stumps, but you can go out and scatter seed by hand or whatever method you have available. On a larger area like that, you would prefer to do it mechanically.
Yeah.
And you can mix the seed with a carrier like pelletized lime. And you use a couple hundred pounds or maybe 100 pounds per acre of pelletized lime, and you put it in a little box spreader on the back of a tractor. And you mix the seed in there, and the pelletized lime serves as a carrier and a dilutant. And you can just go across the area with the seed pelletized lime mixture in that little broadcast spinner seeder on the back of a tractor, broadcast seeder. The only problem with this is that You have to make sure that if there are any other plants growing there, weeds, et cetera, you need to get those under control before you put any seed down. Going back to our theme here of site preparation, make sure if you've got other plants, weeds, trees, shrubs, et cetera, that have come up that were existing under that canopy before the tornado destroyed it, you want to make sure you eliminate those before you put any seeds down. And that could be a 1, maybe even a 2-year process, depending upon what's growing there.
But it sounds like an ideal situation for you. And as I look, you know, white pine sheep, there may not have been much in the way of plants underneath.
There may not have been, but it's something you want to look at. Yeah. I know we have a number of customers who will do a pine harvest, like in a red pine plantation or white pine, and they cut everything down, and now they have an open area. And it's like, hey, let's plant a prairie on that dry, sandy soil. And it's a great option as long as you make sure to control all the existing plants that might have been growing underneath those pines before you seed.
Let's go to Suzanne in Stoughton next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And Neil, you're fantastic. I love it when you're on. We have a city lot. It's a double lot. And on the western side, we have a huge maple tree. So it's super shady. And there's a swatch of lawn that's maybe 100 feet by 20 feet that doesn't grow well and it's pretty useless in general. Mm-hmm. And so we want to start transitioning it. And, you know, even manicured stuff doesn't work very well there because we've got the shade and the root system.
Yep.
So if we go through and we do smothering with cardboard and wood chips, we just got a dump truck load from Chip Drop. Is there any sort of native or prairie preparation that might grow within that area?
Well, I wouldn't recommend prairie plants because most prairie plants need at least 50% direct sun per day. And so under the shade of that maple tree, it's going to be tough. And you know, you pointed out the two factors that why gardening under maple trees is particularly difficult. Number one, the shade, and number two, the surface root systems. Most of your maples have very superficial root systems. Silver maple, Norway maple, sugar maple, these have roots very close to the surface. So there's not a lot of soil for your plants to root into. That doesn't mean that there are not many native plants that can grow there. And the addition of the wood chips, the cardboard wood chips method, does give you a little more quote-unquote soil with those wood chips, but that's going to dissipate over time. And the other interesting thing is that maples have one of the highest leaf area index of any of our native trees, meaning the number of layers of leaves from between the top of the tree and the ground level. So they tend to be among the shadiest of all. So you want to pick plants that are not deep-rooted. Okay, but fortunately, most of our woodland, our native woodland plants, are not terribly deep-rooted, as opposed to our prairie plants, which grow in the sun. They tend to be more deep-rooted, although there are notable exceptions. So most of our native woodland plants have a good fighting chance growing under maples, but you will have to feel your way between those roots and find the pockets of soil to have success. Now, there are some plants that are shallow-rooted that can creep and crawl, and one of those is wild ginger. Well, ginger is also extremely shade tolerant, and if you go into some of these native woods, and you'll see, like under white cedar, which is even more dense shade than sugar maple, you'll find nothing growing there except wild ginger. It's incredibly shade tolerant. So wild ginger is an excellent choice, and its roots are mostly only 2 inches deep, and it can creep and crawl actually over the top of those roots of the maples. So that's one choice. If you want a really aggressive native plant, this is a great problem solver plant. It's not a garden plant normally, and that's zigzag goldenrod, Solidago flexicaulis. And man, that thing will take over. You can put that up against
anything.
At my house, I have the May apple zigzag goldenrod war. And May apple creeps quite a bit. Zigzag goldenrod is beating it. I love torturing plants. See who wins. So
there you go.
You might have good results also with May apple. So look for rhizomatous species that tend not to be too deeply rooted, and those are the plants that will be successful for you. Not to say that there aren't others that are a little more deeper rooted. As you get farther away from the maple tree, you can use more deeply rooted plants. But up close to the trunk, that's where you're going to really run into trouble. Use those tough rhizomatous species there. Good luck, Suzanne.
Thank you for calling. Neil DeBull, our guest, president of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him back, and certainly I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Pam in Green Bay next. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a deep lot, and in the way back, yesterday I found some poison ivy growing, which really surprised me. So my question is, how do you get rid of poison ivy, preferably naturally? You were talking about the white cedar and how to smother it, and I was wondering if that might be an option.
I would start out by saying, Pam, I know another Pam from Madison, Wisconsin, who bought a new house, bought another house, and in the backyard area of her place, she saw some plants, and in her shorts and a sort of a light top, pulled those out by hand, and then discovered that they were poison ivy.
Well, that was what I was going to recommend, Larry. Only we would take the necessary precautions.
I hope Pam from Madison is listening today.
Oh, my God. Yes, well, I've had a similar experience when digging plants in a friend's woods in early spring when everything was dormant.
Oh.
And so I was digging by their seed stalks, and I knew those were woodland plants, and I dug them. But I didn't know that it was a complete bed of poison ivy.
Oh.
And I got the root juice all over my hands. And we were out in his woods. It's up north. And there was no place to wash up. I had no idea what I had done. I got full body, head to toe, poison ivy everywhere. And unfortunately, I do mean everywhere.
Ooh.
Oh, my God, is that painful. So, yes, you want to be extremely careful with poison ivy. So there are herbicides that will kill it and kill it quite handily. There are specific herbicides, broadleaf herbicides, brush-killing herbicides for it. But to do it naturally, this is what I do on my property. I do not spray poison ivy. I actually go out there and I break all the rules and I do it by hand with no gloves, which is incredibly stupid. So don't do what I do at my house. But it has a rhizome. Here, where we live in Wisconsin, it crawls underground. Usually it does not go up trees. You go farther south, and you'll find it growing up trees, and it can be 6 inches in diameter crawling up in trees like giant grapevines. Oh, my God. And you take a hatchet, and you chop them off and treat the stump with an herbicide, brush-killing herbicide, to kill it. And don't get that juice on you. The root juice and the stem juice is the worst, much worse than the leaves. Any rate, so I go out I'm usually invariably working on something else, like pulling buckthorn or something. Oh, there's poison ivy. Don't have any gloves on. And what's interesting is, as long as you only touch it with your palms or your fingers, okay, you'll never get poison ivy. As soon as it touches the back of your hands or your arms or your legs, you're screwed. Okay.
Oh.
But as long as you only touch the palms, so I will go out there and dig it out by hand,
no.
Only touching my palms, and then go inside and wash up. Not recommended. Put on heavy gloves. Okay, put on your poison ivy gloves, okay, because you're not going to want to use these for anything else because that oil will stay on them. Okay, and you can use like heavy-duty rubber gloves as opposed to leather gloves.
Yeah.
Leather gloves will absorb the oil. The rubber gloves, you can wash it off. And you can go out there and dig out the roots. And you get a trowel and dig them out and put them in a pail and then throw them away. And clean out that pail and clean off those gloves. And then go wash, 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 wash everywhere. That's the organic way. You could also smother them for a couple of years, but then you'll smother everything else. Mine are associated with other plants in my woods, so I just go and carefully dig them up. And I get on them right away before they creep, because they will creep and crawl and make a big patch.
There you go, Pam. Good luck. Otherwise, as you said, there are herbicides out there.
Yes, if you want to spray them. But remember that the herbicides that kill the poison ivy will usually kill flowers and other trees and woody plants.
Yeah.
So if you want to do it naturally, it's perfectly reasonable. You can dig it out by hand. But you want to take all the necessary precautions. Do not use the Neil only touch the palms method, because you might not be happy with the results if you're not careful. Put on the neoprene gloves. Go out there with your trowel. Wash off the trowel. Wash off the gloves. Wash off the pail and dispose of that stuff. Get it. Don't put it in the compost pile.
No, for sure. Pam, thank you for calling. Mark in Waukesha. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about different ground covers that can be used on like a steep area. I have an area between two lot lines that is just extremely hard to mow because of its angle and its pitch. So right now there's grass growing there, and when I cut it, it dies. I think maybe something to do with the angle of the sunshine, and it's just too hot to cut it too short. I'd like an alternative that's very low maintenance that doesn't have to be cut at all. that I could grow there that wouldn't, like, get out of control and spread everywhere. I was wondering if you had any ideas about that.
Mark, let me ask you some questions.
Okay.
Okay, what direction does this slope face?
To the west.
Slope to the west. Okay, and it's full sun?
There's some trees in the yard. There should be a little bit of shade there. But I think maybe part of the reason that it's dying off is because when you mow it, and it's so steep, the mower really isn't cutting at the right height.
Right.
And so I'm cutting it either too short or too long or something. And I'm just not a fan of cutting that because there are times when you can actually slip. It's so steep and,
oh, yeah.
And let the mower get away from you.
Well, you got to put the mower on a rope like I did when I was a kid on our front lawn. And then you got to let it down the hill on a rope and then bring it up. And make sure you use an electric mower like we did, and then you can cut the cord. Because the old electric mowers had the electric cord. You didn't have them like the new ones. Then you'd have to – I learned how to splice wires really well at a young age. But at any rate, I just want to make sure I understand your sun conditions. And so you have full sun to part shade. Is that correct?
Yeah, there is one large tree that must make its way across the yard with its shadow, but the rest of the time it's sun.
Okay, and what is the soil type?
It's Waukesha.
So terrible.
Sand and gravel? Waukesha sand and gravel?
You can dig a foot and you'll fill a pail with rocks and get a teaspoon of dirt.
Got it. Okay, Waukesha sand and gravel. Okay, got it. All righty. So it's a dry, mostly sunny site. So you need something that's going to grow in a dry, extremely well-drained situation on a west-facing slope, which is your second hottest slope after a south-facing slope. The south-facing slope is the hottest because it gets the direct heat of the sun in midday. The west slope gets heat in the afternoon, and it also has the prevailing winds from the west, which will desiccate plants on that. So, and when you mow, the general rule of thumb with a lawn, with lawn grasses, is you never want to take more than one-third of the total leaf length off. So if the lawn is, say, 3 inches tall, you don't want to take more than 1 inch off because then you damage the plant and the roots. So if you allow, because you don't want to mow it, you wait until it's long and then you mow it down to the ground and that really whacks the grass. I mean, I know how this is. I hate mowing too. So here's the issue here is that in order to have a landscape that does not grow up to trees and shrubs, in our climate, you either have to mow, burn, or graze, or use herbicides. Those are your four options. Herbicides to keep trees and shrubs from invading it and turning it into a woods. So you have to either mow it, burn it, graze it, or use herbicides to kill trees and shrubs. So now, given those contexts, which of those are you able to do? And willing to do. You may not want to use herbicides.
What are you willing to do?
Yeah, you're probably not going to put goats on there. I'm just guessing.
No, definitely no goats. I guess I might be stuck mowing it.
Are you in the city? Can you not burn this?
Well, no, I can't burn this. I'm in the city of Waukesha. So, but I think it was the edge between two farm fields many, many years ago. And so I think I got the brunt of every rock that was in the field thrown there and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, it might have something to do with why it's, you know, tough to mow or why it, I think it would probably erode by now if it weren't so rocky.
Sure. Well, we do have a product called our No-Mow Lawn Mix, and it is a combination of six different fine fescues, which will grow in very dry, rocky soils like this. So I would think it would grow well for you. The only problem is that you do occasionally need to mow that, like maybe once a year, so trees and shrubs don't get established in there. So it's a lower maintenance lawn. It's slower growing. It's very drought tolerant, so it might be a good option for you. Is everything pretty much dead there now?
Well, browned out, I would say.
Okay, it's browned out, but the grass isn't actually dead. It's going to come back.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not dead. Okay. So that grass is going to come back. So if you were to put a new grass seed on there now, it probably wouldn't do very well because you have existing grass sod in place, which is going to maintain its dominance. So you would have to eliminate what's growing there now to replace it with something else, no matter what you choose. If you could burn it, you could put in prairie grasses like Side Oats Grandma and Little Bluestem, which are short prairie grasses, which will love that dry, rocky soil. So that's another option. But, you would have to eliminate all of the existing material, all the existing plants, and then you would have to burn it like every other year, or you could mow it once a year. But that's harder to mow than a lawn because it's denser grass, the prairie grass.
Yeah. singing about remembering back in my youth when I tipped a riding lawnmower over on a slope.
Oh, my God.
I was lucky I did not kill myself.
Yeah.
I tipped it right over.
See, burning is safer than mowing.
Yeah, maybe.
Without it done right.
Maybe when nobody's looking, Mark.
What is it? It's better to ask forgiveness and permission? No, I'm kidding.
No.
So, yeah, you don't want to get in trouble with the authorities. So anyway, that's always a very challenging situation is maintaining some kind of a grass cover on a slope, especially in our climate where trees and shrubs will innately tend to invade. So.
Jim wonders if you can kill quackgrass by smothering it.
Yes, absolutely.
How long?
Year.
A year you can kill quackgrass in a year.
Yep, you should. If you start in April 1st through the end of October, you should be able to smother it.
And then you can plant something else in
plant
there.
Some, yeah, and then take it up and then put down your seed.
Neil DeBole, our guest today. What's your website address?
Oh, Prairie Nursery, www.prairienursery.com. And if you don't have access to the web, you can give us a call and order a catalog at 800-476-9453. That's 1-800-GROW-WILD, baby.
Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist in the Prairie area. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Oh, I'm going to be singing that song in my head all afternoon. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. That was Lisa Johnson, our Dane County Horticulture Extension Specialist. And the song is The Season from one of her CDs, and you can download it from CD Baby. And Neil DeBole is the expert with me in the studio from Prairie Nursery. And always great to have him come by to talk with you and with me about prairies. And I hope you'll join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. We will take some calls here. Paul in Arcadia is up next. Hi, Paul.
Morning. Larry, I always love the show. I appreciate everything you guys do. And got a question on prairie that I put in about 14 years ago. I'm over in Arcadia. It's a wet messick, but the problem is it's gotten neglected over the last 3 years, and a small portion of it's been overtaken by goldenrod. And so I'm looking at this time of year, the best way to try to get that knocked down and get something reestablished there.
Okay, I got a question for you, Paul. Goldenrod, yep, being the Canada goldenrod, I presume?
Yes.
Okay, got it. The usual suspect.
The one we don't want. Yep. But I've got some of the zigzag goldenrod that's growing nice in there. But what I had done was it was right by a ditch, and it was about a third of an acre, and so I planted the front edge of it in a shorter grass mix that I got from a prairie supplier over in Winona. You might know them. But that never really took. It either washed into the ditch, but because right up above it, I've got some tall grass, and the big blue stem's going crazy up there. And so I'd like to try to do something with a shorter variety in there so that it doesn't block that off from the view from the road.
Yeah.
Well, here's your first issue. You said this is a wet mesic site, Paul?
Correct.
Okay, most of your prairie grasses don't do well in a wet mesic site. They're not competitive for a variety of reasons. Number one, little blue stem, side oats grama, like a drier soil. They don't like too much moisture. And prairie drop seed, which will grow in more moisture, one of your other short grasses, is extremely slow to establish and usually takes about 5 years from seed to become established. And you have to plant it either in the fall or early spring. If you plant it in later spring or early summer, the seed very seldom germinates at anything approaching a reasonable rate. So establishment is dependent upon your seeding time. So it's a little trickier. So normally, when we're in a wet mesic situation, we are reduced to using mostly the taller grasses. There are some shorter grasses that will grow in wet mesic situations, but they tend not to be robust enough to compete with all the bad guys that can get in there in those richer moisture soils. So you got to fight fire with fire. You got to use the big, tall prairie plants if you're going to be successful in those rich wet mesic sites. So that's the first issue. So the whole approach here would be that you need some heavy hitters to go up against the bad guys in that wet mesic site. Now, that may not be what you want there, so you may have to rethink your plan as far as what to plant there. I don't know if that's possible, or what do you think?
It is. What if I was just to go with just pure forbs? Would I run into the same problem there, just the competition?
It'll depend upon the forbs. Normally, we include grasses with the forbs because the grasses have the fibrous root systems that really help to compete against the weeds. A lot of your forbs have tap roots or corms and bulbs that don't occupy that surface soil, and that's where all kinds of weeds can become established, although there are some very competitive fibrous-rooted forbs. And I'll tell you, you ever plant cup plant?
That's one I don't have. I've got Prairie Dock, and I got the compass plant, but not the cup.
Well, you plant cup plant down there in that wet mesic site, and it's going to be all cup plant. I don't care what you put in there with it. And it's going to get 10 feet tall. It's going to eat that place alive, and you don't need any grasses with it because it will control just about everything. But, again, it's going to be contrary to what you want to do there. You're going to have a 10-foot tall plant instead of a 4-foot tall plant.
Yeah.
So you're kind of only given so much with which to work from Mother Nature on this, and you're also up against these aggressive weeds like the goldenrod, and you need to have the heavy hitters that can fight it out with these guys. So I think you need to really look at what you want there versus what is feasible and realistic as far as being successful.
There you go. Good luck. Requires some more thought there, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Sue from Chippewa Falls, and I don't know if you can look on your screen there, sent us some photos and asks if this is a prairie or weeds. They planted this 10 years ago, and you can take a look on my screen here, and you probably can see. She's wondering if those golden plants are prairie grass.
Okay. Once again, the theme of the day
is
Canada goldenrod.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Yeah. But
there is some either brown-eyed Susan or sweet black-eyed Susan in there.
Yeah, a little shorter.
Yeah, but all those tall yellow flowers with kind of spiky flower heads on them are Canada goldenrod, and it is really a beast. You really have to be careful when you're dealing with this plant. If you ever see it become established, you have to go after it. On my property, I completely eliminated everything before I planted my prairie, but some Canada goldenrod has blown in by seed because the seeds are disseminated by the wind, and so I go out after a rain, and you get a dandelion digger, and I pull them out and dig out those rhizomes. And I'm able to keep them pretty well under control as long as I walk. It's less than an acre, and it's isolated in really in a couple areas. So I'm able to go in there and just dig those out and remove them, get them out of there. But you got to dig. You got to follow that rhizome because the rhizome runs laterally, and you want to get all that rhizome if you can. If it breaks off, then it'll come back, and you got to go back and get it again.
Let's go to Bev in Door County. Hi, Bev.
Hi, Larry and Neil.
Hi.
I'm calling with a problem of the combination of a perennial garden, a new, brand new perennial garden, and rabbits. We put a perennial garden in about 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months. Coneflowers, Shasta daisies, and black-eyed Susans. This is an area about 15 by 20. And within a week and a half, the rabbits, by the way, they didn't put them in from seed. They put in plants about 8 to 10 inches tall, 12 inches maybe. And within 2 weeks, the whole area was just destroyed by the rabbits. And I'm wondering, we need to do something. It cost us $1,300 to have a landscaper put them in. and wondering what we can do now. We want to do it right this time.
Pesky rabbits.
Yeah.
Rabbits are worse than deer. Deer are a little more picky in what they eat, so they'll leave certain plants alone, but rabbits seem to be quite Catholic with a small C in their taste, wide-ranging. So how do you deal with rabbits? You can spray the plants with a rabbit repellent, which you have to do every X number of weeks or month, depending upon the repellent and the rainfall, etc., which is a perfectly reasonable approach. You can put a chicken wire fence around it to keep the rabbits out, which is most attractive. So now you have this unsightly chicken wire fence around your garden. And I have, you know, I used to attempt to grow hostas. I'm a native plant guy, but I had to fence my hostas with 5-foot fences to keep the deer out. And so I kind of gave up on that. They ate them all. So, okay, done with that little experiment. The only place I left is where I have this old woven wire 5-foot fence where the deer can't get into it. So anyway, you need to protect them either with a repellent or a fence. Or, as my neighbor would say, you can use lead poisoning, a 22. But that's a lot of time. You got to get them all, and that's almost impossible. So I think fencing or repellent is really
the only way. Repellents? Is there one you like better than another?
Larry, you know what? I don't use those. I'm kind of a – in my house, if it doesn't grow on its own and if the deer don't eat it – and I don't have rabbits because we're fortunate that we have lots of hawks and owls where I live. And so the rabbit populations are very much under control. So I'm not really well-versed on that. But there are some that are really improved and can last up to a month or longer. So, but you'd have to do some research. I'm sorry. I'm not really the person for that.
All right. There you go, Bev. Thank you for calling. Guy in Adams County – your turn. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Larry. I live, like I say, I live in Adams County, and here we have pretty sandy soil. I'd really love to grow chestnut trees on my property, and I was wondering, would they do well here?
Well,
what would you say would be the best variety for eating also and hardiness?
Well, you're a little bit out of my area of expertise. There are three basic chestnuts. There are the Chinese chestnuts, the European chestnut, and the American chestnut. And we can grow the American chestnut here because there are no nearby disease vectors. In fact, I can show you a beautiful American chestnut that was planted in 1914 right next to our nursery in Marquette County, right next to you. A huge tree. It's like 40 inches in diameter because there are no nearby chestnuts that would carry the fungus that attacks the chestnuts, which wiped them out 100 years ago, 120 years ago in the East. You can, if you have an isolated population, escape from that fungal disease. Then you have the Chinese chestnuts and the European chestnuts. I planted all three of these on my property. The polar vortex of 2014 whacked back my American chestnuts that were in the open. The ones in the woods survived. The one that was in the open died back to the ground, did not come up the next year, but the second year it resprouted, and now it's a nice young tree. Okay. But last year's winter killed my European chestnut. The Chinese chestnut, which one is it? I can't remember. The Chinese or the European got killed last year. No signs of resprouting this year. Maybe it'll come back next year. Okay. So you have hardiness issues, and you also have soil issues, because I'm assuming you have very dry, sandy soil typical of Adams County. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So you might have some nutritional issues. I've grown my American chestnuts in a variety of soils. In a drier, sandy soil, they're going to be really, really slow. That doesn't mean you cannot do it. But is there moisture close to the surface within 2 to 3 feet, or is it going to be dry all the way down deeply?
I guess it would depend on the weather, you know, with the rain and that. I have a question. If I would, if it's feasible to grow, I believe I'd go with the American chestnut. I'd make sure I water them good, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, soil nutrition is also a factor. So yeah. Those dry, sandy soils, it's not to say you can't do it, okay, because they're quite drought tolerant. And they grew, if you look at where they grew in the East in the Appalachian Mountains, they grew on dry, rocky hillsides, south-facing and west-facing hillsides. So they're pretty drought tolerant. It takes a while for them to get established, but if they can get down into moisture soil below, then they'll often take off. So you can give it a try, but they're moderate in their growth rate on good soil, slow on poor, sandy soils like you have in Adams County. That's not to say you can't do it, but you may have some hardiness issues like mine in the open that got whacked in 2014 during the polar vortex. You might have some mortality.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Guy. And Chuck in Wisconsin Dells, your turn.
thank you. I appreciate it. I just wonder if my spot spraying with Roundup on sand burrs will kill the seeds.
No. Roundup does not kill seeds. It's purely a foliar contact herbicide, and as soon as it hits the ground, its ability to kill plants, seeds, or anything else is rendered useless. And I have tested this myself. So, no, it will not kill the seeds. It's strictly a foliar herbicide. Aren't sand burrs wonderful?
Oh, they're terrible. I remember visiting my aunt and uncle in Adams County, and all those sand burrs were just drove me nuts as a young kid.
And they've got some kind of stinging fluid on them. It's not just that point. It's something they inject something into you, man. It just continues to sting. It's just terrible. They're horrible. Horrible. Larry, I'd like to make a point on something.
Yeah.
The goldenrod has been kind of a theme today.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make sure people know that there are ways to control the goldenrod. Okay.
Okay.
None of them – this is Canada goldenrod now. Okay.
Right.
None of them are particularly simple. But I have a client out in Verona who developed a method quite serendipitously on his own where he just got sick of the Canada goldenrod, which was invading a part of a prairie that I had planted for him. And it just started off of an edge of a fence line where he didn't get rid of the goldenrod. And so he went out in June – middle of June, and mowed it down to 6 inches. This is in an established prairie. So he's mowing back his prairie plants. He mowed to 6 inches. And then in late August, when the goldenrod was getting ready to bloom, he mowed it at 12 inches. Because by August, the stems of the Canada goldenrod, there's no vegetation below about a foot.
Yeah.
So there's nothing there that will be damaged by mowing. So he went up to where the leaves started at about 12, 14 inches, leaving the prairie plants 12 to 14 inches high. Okay. Again, he's mowing his prairie in the middle of August. I mean, he's mowing his tall grass prairie down 5-6 feet tall, and he's mowing it down to a foot. This is very invasive surgery. He happened to be a doctor. Okay, so he did this 2 years in a row, and it almost completely eliminated the Canada goldenrod, and his prairie was fine because the plants survived the mowing. But he did a 6-inch mowing in mid-June, a 12-inch height mowing in late August, 2 years in a row where there was dense Canada goldenrod. Within 2 years, it was essentially eliminated. It's a miracle treatment.
Wow.
It's a miracle treatment. Now, I have another friend. Gary Eldred, who is the founder of the Prairie Enthusiasts, he's been doing this for 40-plus years, since the early 70s. And what he does, he has problems with Canada goldenrod in his prairie. What he does is he goes out and he takes binder's twine and he ties, because the Canada goldenrod grows in clones in big patches, he ties like 10 or 12 of them, the stems, together at about 3 foot high. And now he's got a whole bunch of the heads, okay, up about 5 feet high, and he takes a little, like a plant mister that you would mist your plants with, and puts it on stream, not spray, so there's no drift, and then he puts either a broadleaf herbicide or glyphosate in there, and he sprays just the tops of those plants where he's got them controlled in that cluster. So there's no dripping and no drift onto any other beneficial plants. What you'll often find is in a prairie that has been invaded by Canada goldenrod, there's still lots of good prairie plants underneath it. And this was the case with my client who mowed. His prairie plants came back beautifully and filled in. And with Gary's case, what he's found is that after he kills those goldenrods with that treatment, by bundling and then treating them, the prairie plants underneath it the next year come back and bloom. And he gets rid of the Canada goldenrod, and he's got the prairie completely rejuvenated. So there are ways to handle this. Obviously, what he's doing is not something you would do on large acreages. It would be in smaller areas where you're bundling and treating. What Dr. Atwell did was he did the June, August, 6-inch, 12-inch, 6-inch, 12-inch mowing for 2 years on a larger acre. It's like a couple acres, and it worked beautifully. So there are ways to handle this. So I just want to make sure people knew there are organic methods using mowing, and there are herbicide methods using the bundling and treating method.
Speaking of doctors, a former ER doctor called to ask you to reiterate the gloves that should be used to pull poison ivy.
Okay, you want to have a neoprene or heavy-duty glove that does not retain the oil of the poison ivy that can be washed off. Not a cotton glove, not a leather glove, because those can absorb the oils of the poison ivy. And the next time you use them, if you're not careful, oh my God, now you've got poison ivy juice on you. Ain't nothing worse than poison ivy juice.
And you're living proof.
I am living proof. I tell you what, when you have poison ivy for a month from head to toe on every surface of your body, you gain a tremendous respect for that stuff. That's why I go out and pull them by hand. But I'm really super careful. I know where they are.
Oh, man. Kawa in Arlington. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I don't know if you remember me, but I was a student of yours a couple of years ago.
Oh, hi, Kawa.
Nice to talk to you. Anyway, I had an inquiry or a recommendation, rather, for a caller that was asking about short grasses that he wanted to plant in a wet mesic area, and you recommended that he use tall grasses that would compete with Canada goldenrod better or cup plant and silviums. But I was wondering if sedges would be a good alternative.
Yeah, sedges are great for moist soils, and you know, we use a plant called fox sedge, sometimes called brown fox sedge, Carex vulpinoidea, which is really our go-to plant in rain gardens where we mix it with flowers for pollinators. Mm-hmm. And it's a great choice. The problem is that it has difficulty because it only grows a couple feet tall. Even though it has nice, dense, fibrous root systems, it sometimes is not able to compete at the foliar zone with taller invasive plants. So it's an outstanding choice for a wet mesic, wet prairie situation. But sometimes it just can't defend itself against the big, tall guys. So, and sedges are great. Love sedges. So we offer a lot of sedges for wetland wet areas and for woodland areas. But I just worry about getting overtopped by the big guys. Now, you can put in other tall forbs with the fox sedge, and that might be able to fend off the bad guys. And the problem with the big tall grasses is they can become overly aggressive, which I think is what Calla is concerned about.
Yeah.
What happens to the forbs when you got a bunch of big blue stem and switchgrass in there, the big tall guys, which tend to reduce the viability of the forbs. So you can use some big tall forbs in there, which will also then give you pollinator services that you won't get from grasses because they're wind pollinated instead of insect pollinated.
Calla, good to hear your voice again. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. We had Fred in Spring Green. He's been working, preparing his site with sandy soil. He did a spring burn, been using chemicals to kill the growth. But does he really have to go 2 years to kill everything?
That depends on what's growing there. If it was an old field full of all sorts of weeds and with all the weed seeds hiding in the soil, dormant, 2 years is really, really a wise thing to do. Because you want to not only make sure you've killed all the existing perennial vegetation, but at least reduce the density of weed seeds. And don't till it up before you seed it. Don't till it up. So.
And what's your website again? You know, I want to give that website because you do have so much good information on it.
Yeah. As I like to tell people, we have three products: plants, seeds, and information. Mm-hmm. And information is the most important one because without the information, you can't do the best possible job. So you can go to www.prairienursery, PRAIRIENursery.com. And if you want to look for plants, so we have a really great function on there. On the left-hand side of the homepage, there's a service called Plant Finder. And you click on Plant Finder and you put in your soil, your sun, your moisture, the flower colors you want, the height you want, if you want grasses, you want flowers, you want ferns, and it will generate a list for you to match your specific site conditions and personal desires for your garden.
Perfect. Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and you'll come back, I hope.
I love coming to be with you on the show, Larry. It's so much fun. Thank you so very much.
Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery. We will have him back, and we will do this again with him. Monday, we'll talk astronomy with Paul Kinzer and weather with our weather guys as well. So I hope you can join in for that. But in the meantime, you know, there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. So you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.